This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Hurting Code. Tonight is April 14th, 2010. We have a surprise guest on tonight, Rob Connery. Rob, you've never been on the show, but we'll guide you through the process. Everything will go smoothly.
Is it over yet? I gotta go. I got work to do.
So tonight we're going to talk about Ruby on Rails and Kevin's wacky adventures on it, and also talking about, so I guess that's Kevin on Ruby on Rails.
Kevin on Rails, look out.
Yes, and then also putting JavaScript on the server, which is just nuts. So on the Kevin on Rails part, so Kevin, you recently accidentally started writing Ruby on Rails or something?
Yeah, well, I tripped over something and kind of fell into a big pile of rails. No, it's not nothing earth shattering. I just have kind of been getting the itch to play around with some alternate frameworks. So I decided to watch Rob's wonderful Tech Pub series on BYOB, Build Your Own Blog on Rails, and kind of start dipping my toes in the water a little bit. And yeah, so far it's been very cool. I mean, I haven't gotten too far with it yet, I'm really enjoying it. So.
Are you using Rails 2 or Rails 3 in beta?
I am using Rails 2 right now, mostly for two reasons. One is I'm starting with the RubyMine IDE from JetBrains because I don't know, I need somebody to hold my hand a little bit through this process, I guess. And being, you know, a Microsoft-oriented developer, we love our IDEs. And they don't have Rails 3 support yet. But also because just the idea of figuring it all out with all the sort of beta messiness seemed like more daunting than I wanted to tackle from the beginning. Although I don't know if that's a legitimate concern or if that's, you know, just me being pussy. But Rob, have you done Rails 3 work? You have any comments on the state of the?
Yeah, a little bit. I've dabbled with it, although having, you know, spent the last 6 years of my life, you know, for some reason being on the front lines with new launches of ASP.NET, you know, XYZ frameworks. It hurts, you know, when you kind of get a thing going, you get like a sample rolling, you kind of get your mental mind or your mental model in your mind kind of wrapped around like, oh, wow, okay, well, that's what this is. And then boom, stuff changes and like everything breaks. It's really discouraging. I mean, it's really masochistic. And, you know, as much as I really enjoy people beating on me, I like to dabble a little bit, but yeah, I haven't really got that far into it. Although, one thing that I've really come to enjoy about it is Rack and playing with the Rack interface. You know, have you touched Rack at all, Kevin?
No, not yet. No.
Well, I think, you know, RubyMine's a great place to start. I mean, it's a great IDE, and I wouldn't say instantly familiar, but it has kind of all the same feel-good things that Visual Studio does. And you know, you got your IntelliSense, and it's a good way to learn the language of Ruby if you don't know what's really going on. But moreover, you know, you got your testing stuff built in. It's by JetBrains, and so if you're familiar with ReSharper and the bells and whistles there, I mean, there's a lot of goodness with RubyMine. I mean, I don't know.
I was going to say it's kind of a cross between the TextMate experience with ReSharper refactorings built in, and they work on JavaScript as well in RubyMine.
That's great.
It's got integration with Git and Subversion. I think there's a Mercurial plugin too. It's really impressive. The only part that's not impressive is the memory usage and the startup time. It has gotten better since the 1.0.
I have basically what is basically a trivial Rails app, and RubyMine is taking 500 megs of memory. Which
it takes up like 250 just at startup with nothing loaded.
Now, this reminds me of something we're going to talk about later, but with Visual Studio 2010 just shipping and Iron Ruby also just doing something magical. I didn't see it, but at Alt.NET Seattle this past weekend, I believe they showed like file new Ruby on Rails project.
Yeah, Jimmy Chimente did a demo on Iron Ruby and the Enterprise and some other things, and he demoed that, and some jaws dropped.
I saw that on Twitter. That's amazing. That's great. Something worth touching on really quickly. You know, so many people, I just actually had a conversation with I think someone on Twitter emailed basically saying, why have you jumped to Rails? And I haven't. I really haven't. It's to me, and I think Scott, you can probably echo this a little bit, that you know, the more that you see what's out there, the more ideas you can bring back into your daily practice. And Kevin, I think, you know, hopefully you're going to see that soon, that once you kind of get past the initial, like, where am I pain? This doesn't look like my VB6 stuff I see every day. You know, all of a sudden you're like, whoa, you know, I really like the way they do named routes, for instance, in Rails, or I really like the way they do that little thing. And I could do that in an MDC app with a little extension method, and that would really cut down some pain. Anyway, it's worth pointing out that just because you're trying it doesn't mean you're leaving the farm, you know?
Well, so to tie in Rack with the Iron Ruby stuff that they demoed and released yesterday, just because you're trying out Rails doesn't necessarily mean you have to leave the Windows platform.
Nope.
And Rob, have you tried running Rails apps under Iron Ruby or under IIS with the Rack plugin that the Iron Ruby team released?
Not the Rack plugin yet. I really want to try that. I think it'd be a lot of fun. I tried running Cucumber under Iron Ruby, and it was an interesting experience. But this was back in, I think, when it was .7 or something like that. And they had a lot of startup problems. You know, when Iron Ruby would first invoke the DLR, there was a huge lag time to the point where running a Cucumber test was like, okay, I'm going to go make a sandwich, maybe have a beer, then go to bed, wake up in the morning, and, oh, hey, look at that, my test ran.
Now, I thought there was an Iron Ruby-specific gem for, like, Cucumber and RSpec. Did she use that, or were you just trying just plain Cucumber? Or am I wrong?
I don't remember. I don't honestly. It might have been RSpec. I can't remember, honestly.
I will use the power of Google.
Bingle.
Bungle? What?
Someone just called me evil on Twitter. Not very nice.
Yeah, I have a kind of a really hard time getting excited about Iron Ruby. I mean, am I the only one? It just kind of doesn't seem like, it seems like if you're going to go with Ruby, you want to like get all the great advantages of Ruby, which is, you know, sort of platform independence and cheap hosting and, you know, this sort of, you know, all the Heroku, like, awesome deployment stuff. And, like, you know, so doing it all in Iron Ruby just doesn't seem like...
But how would you be giving that up? I mean, can't you develop in Iron Ruby, but you're writing Ruby code, right? I mean, you're not...
Yeah, but, I mean, the Iron Ruby part of it doesn't seem like it adds all that much. I mean, it's Ruby running on the .NET framework, but, what does that give you that just running plain old Ruby doesn't give you?
Well, I guess one thing would be, you know, like, you can use Visual Studio, which if you're familiar with it and, you know, you're jumping back and forth in different projects.
But there isn't Visual Studio tooling around all the Ruby stuff, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that's part of the hesitance that I've been feeling with Iron. There's no story there, you know, and coming from the Microsoft universe, I mean, there's always a story behind something, meaning like what's the angle, what's the pitch, what are we going to do here with this thing? And Iron Ruby just is. And, you know, woohoo, it doesn't really... So, in other words, maybe a great place for it would be an Iron Ruby view engine, you know, or maybe, I don't know, some greater support with an automatic tooling and IntelliSense and like you're saying, Kevin, things that are worked in and how you would use it. And PNP coming out with, like, here's PNP with Iron Ruby or something, but it's just kind of there.
If it was like a, you know, Ruby and Steel thing where they give you all this, like, you know, integrated tooling around Ruby, then I could see it. But I don't know. It just seems like if you're going to do Ruby, there's nothing really compelling about Iron Ruby to me, except as some sort of bridge, you know, between the Ruby world and the .NET world. You know, if you need to live on both sides of it.
One thing that you've said in passing was the idea of a Ruby view engine, and I remember there is Iron Python support in Spark, and I thought there was also Iron Ruby. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's Iron Ruby support in Spark, yeah.
Yeah.
And that does kind of lead us to the next thing that we were going to talk about in terms of, you know, do we want to go there yet? Is C# the best language for writing views?
No.
In ASP.NET MVC? Are there other alternatives? Would it be better to... So one of the things that we started our fishbowl with at Alt.NET Seattle was we need to come up with something controversial. So Panes of Glass, Ryan on Twitter, came up with a topic. All UIs, due to their ever-changing nature, should be written using a dynamic language. And, you know, feel free to write your models and maybe controllers in any kind of, you know, statically typed language you want. And that was kind of what we started Fishbowl with, except no one really disagreed. They all thought that it was a pretty good idea to write views in a dynamic language and you know, to have all the kind of heavy iron stuff on the back end, services or anything that needs to integrate with, you know, Oracle financials or databases or whatever in C#, you know, that's fine.
So what's the major pain, though? I mean, because the views are like a string, right? So, I mean, you have to recompile if you change your server-side code, but if you change a view, it's you can just edit and refresh and you're done. And most of the view code that I'm writing, especially with MVC2 and, you know, the Lambda syntax and the strongly typed helpers and blah, 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 it's like I'm writing very little. I mean, I'm not writing any logic in the views. So I guess I'm not hitting the pain that people are talking about. Like, why do I need a dynamic language?
Well, it's weird. You know, the thing I found out yesterday, I was so for people out there, I should echo this. Someone on Twitter said I was evil because I'm like evil Ruby on Rails guy. But, you know, as I'm reading that Twitter, I'm looking over in my screen here as I have my new MVC starter site that I'm putting together for our tech pub stuff. And as I was creating it, I was using Haml, you know, the Haml view engine, which I love. And there was a part in it where I had to, I was taking some view data down and I was getting these null errors. I'm like, null errors? Why am I getting null errors? And I have to like, then I have to write code to handle the null checks. Then I have to write code to handle like type conversions, you know, if I'm doing any date stuff, for instance, currency operations, all in all. I mean, like, I don't know. My brain is thinking in CSS/HTML land. And here I'm having to think about null checks. And yes, I'm maybe sounding like a spoiled brat, but dude, null checks in a view just seem like you got to write code to get around that. Next thing you know, you got logic code bleeding in. People sometimes under deadlines will cut corners and just say, well, I'll just quickly just do an if right here with a coalescing blah, da da da. And you got this garbage in your view. And it's, when I say garbage, I don't mean the language is garbage. I mean, it's the excess bleeding of code that you have to put in there to make everything work right.
Yeah.
You know, I gotta say, just in my dabblings with Rails, one thing I really kind of like out of the MVC world is I really like Spark, and I really like the way Spark does things, and I kind of might find myself wanting that sort of model of how you define a view in the Rails world.
You know what you're gonna like better? If you know, I'm gonna make you like it, Kevin. I'm gonna come to your house. I'm gonna like, you know, I'm not gonna let you continue until you try it. It's the Haml view engine for Rails, and here's why. You have to be sick of, you know, less than, you know, / end tag garbage, slinging these tags around. Oh, I forgot to close a div tag and my page goes pear-shaped. With Haml, it is so easy. And think about this, refactoring HTML, when you realize, oh, I need to kind of nest this thing here and push it around over there, is really a pain in the butt. You know, you end up collapsing things in the IDE and you're like, okay, let's make sure I don't screw that div up and make, you know, you might rework your classes. But with Haml, it's so easy. And it's really funny because when I first started using it, a friend of mine kind of pushed me to try it and I thought, all right, whatever. And I sat there and I seriously, by the sixth line of writing it and realizing I don't have to worry about closing tags and the format of the HTML that comes out is all compliant and wonderful. Yeah, I had a revelation. And the funny thing is it forces you, and this is the best part, it forces you to write less code in the view. And because it's ugly, you look at it, you're like, I don't want to see that there. So unless if it's more than one line, then you end up writing a helper somewhere. You don't believe me, do you?
I'm skeptical on Haml. And I looked at Enamel back when it first came out. And I don't know. I got to say, coming from Mr. You know, we don't need ORMs. We just embrace SQL. It's a little surprising to have the abstraction over HTML.
No doubt. Well, here's why. So honestly and truly, I agree with you on that. The alternate view engine thing kind of bugged me. The first thing that gets me to go there is the encoding. The automatic encoding does it for me. That's it. And because how many times have we run into XSS problems? The second thing is, though, that you think in terms of CSS, because that's how Haml's sort of structured. And you output like pound page content, and then you indent underneath it. You know you're working in that because you just wrote it. You know, you're working in that ID. And then underneath that, you'll type in like dot login box or whatever it is. And you know you're working in that class. And it's just, it's phenomenal. It puts your brain right in CSS mode. And not only that, but since you're thinking in those terms and you're visualizing the page in sort of CSS terms, you start to naturally go along with, okay, I'll just wait, I need an ID for this. And it's so easy to flip over to CSS. You add it, go back to your page, add it. Whereas when you're kind of slinging this stuff together in normal HTML mode, which I know you probably have your workflow down for, but you still have to write the tags and it's kind of hard to read. Anyway, that's my thought.
I can buy that. I do like that it pushes you towards, like you're saying, structuring a document, you know, which is like, the whole thing of like you should, you know, you put the same concern into your structure of your HTML as in your view as you do anything else, and it definitely does push you in that direction.
And it's pretty cool too. Like if you go, all the views on my blog are Haml, and I after like 2 hours of writing it, it felt completely natural to me. And if you go to my blog and right click view source, I mean, it's laid out perfectly. I mean, it might not validate because I'm an idiot, but it's the old stuff is HTML, but the new stuff is all Haml. But it's just the way the parser works. It lays it out, indents it just right. It's just really, anyway, so sorry, I derailed that a little bit.
So are there any downsides? Are there any problems you've run into with that?
Well, yeah, but the downsides actually turned out to be a good side. One major downside is like when you need to write code in the view, it's not obvious. JavaScript in the view, you know, you're like, oh man, you know, because it's all white space dependent, indentation dependent, and you start writing JavaScript that doesn't play along with it. But you know what? You shouldn't have it in there. I mean, the simple things like one-liners like, document.ready and so on. Yeah, that you can do, and that's not a big deal. In Rails, you can write filters that do special things that hook into Haml. In nHaml, it's a little bit different. It's very, very finicky. So you really need to push your JavaScript code into a JS file, which is where it should be. And you know, you find yourself writing more than one line of C# code, then you're going to have problems. But you should have problems. And you see what I'm saying? That's one of the really awesome things about it. And in fact, if you train your eye to look at Haml, you can almost instantly grok a page in so little time because you read it as CSS instead of HTML, which for me was the major breakthrough.
I can buy that. So it's not HTML and then adding on some logic, whether you're doing it in any other language. It's a new language that's specific for a view that makes sense for a view.
Right. But I think I completely derailed Kevin. See, I think when you Kevin, that's when he gets quiet and he doesn't.
He's just seething.
I'm actually just looking at some Haml here. I'm willing to give it a try.
Yeah,
it's
interesting stuff. But anyway, so the original question was it a question? I don't know. You're answering something. You were talking about one thing you did miss was Spark. That's what you're saying.
Oh, Spark. Yes, I do actually. I quite like the Spark model relative to, you know, in comparison to ERB. It just, I don't know. It's more HTML-y to me. It looks cleaner to my eye. Anyway, I don't know how we got into that conversation.
Hmm.
Because I asked if you should write all of your views using a dynamic
language. Yes, that's what it was. Yes, that was it.
And well, I said yes.
It is kind of funny. You know, you can literally, when you think about stripping out the end tags of all your HTML, you can decrease the size of your view page by, you know, well, at the most half. And, you know, when you see it, your programmer's mind will take over. It's almost a shock to go and see any, you know, like anything else. Although, you know, you don't want to lose the ability to read HTML, but at the same time, you remove all those angle brackets. Wow. It's so nice. So anyway,
I guess to me, it's like, if you're looking at a view code, it does read nicer, but I usually try and keep views as simple as possible and no logic and all that. And so it's something where I look at it and I'll say like, okay, this would cut a few lines of code out, but would it really like make my day enough to like, you know, move over to another framework, you know? You know what I mean? It's one of those kind of like moving to a new house because, you know, the countertop is half an inch lower or something, you know, it seems like kind of extreme.
Well, Kevin, you brought this up on one of the previous Herding Codes. And when I think is when you guys were interviewing Louis Desjardins, and you know, I think you said specifically just the fact that you can auto encode the output of your HTML is enough reason to use one of these other view engines. And it's funny because a lot of people don't see that as a, you know, they don't take that in consideration because they hear the view engine discussions. They're like, what does it really matter? It's all markup, big deal. But something like that is actually an extremely big deal.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's, I remember when Stack Overflow was like first came out in beta and was just absolutely riddled with cross-site scripting bugs.
Yeah, and the sad part is you could chuckle. You could like, oh, look what I just did. You know, and wait till Jeff sees that page when, you know, it says, hello, Jeff's a dork. But you know that it's not a deficiency of a programmer. This is something that's so, you know, relevant to me, like the programmer who wrote that page, maybe it was Jeff, maybe it wasn't, could be so painfully aware of cross-site scripting and doing everything possible. But, you know, you're going to forget. you are going to forget.
Yeah, it's just way too easy. I mean, it's just you just want it just has to be a pit of success kind of thing. Like the,
absolutely,
you know, the safe. Mm-hmm. The safe approach should be the default approach, you know?
Yeah, and well, I just turned out the security episode for MVC on TechPub, and I was doing like little ghost story, you know, fun things, and Jeff Atwood unfortunately made it on there twice, but it's because Jeff blogged about his travails with Stack Overflow. But the one that I thought was absolutely fascinating is that, you know, they used to allow you to link to an external picture for your avatar, and they forgot to, you know, encode that. And so, and I couldn't tell from his blog post if he said that they were using their own sanitizer, which is always fail. And for those of you out there who want to know, anti-XSS library allows you to sanitize your HTML much better than you can write your own. Anyway,
that's something I remember. I went back and forth with him on that. He was just really focused on the like, it's overkill, and it's I can write a better regular expression, and it look, it's, you know, 10% faster, and uh-huh. You know, it's like, well, yeah.
Well, you know what happened is someone spoofed the URL, mm-hmm. and they injected a malicious script in there that stole Jeff's cookie, and then so the funny thing is the blog post he wrote on it was like, all of this could have been avoided if, you know, you just use HTTP only on your cookies. And I remember reading going, no, actually all of it could have been avoided if you don't write your own sanitizer.
Yeah,
because that's just you know. But anyway, the point being is you get Jeff's login to Stack Overflow, then, you know, and if you're a really evil person, the sky's the limit with what you could do. And you could be stealthy, you're going to be quiet, you might inject other XSS attacks in the database on the really high hit posts, like the Zalgo one about writing HTML regex.
Yeah.
But yeah, you inject certain posts, man, who's going to find out?
Well, and that's something I'm updating that chapter in the Rocks MVC book right now that you've previously written about security. And that was a point you made in there, was that, you know, it's a smart hacker doesn't get caught. They never tell you. They don't, you know, I mean, they're doing exactly what you're saying. So somebody could do something like that and, you know, do nothing. Like that was my little joke that I was, you know, telling people on Twitter before, is like when Jeff's blog went down, you know, it's like somebody could say, oh yeah, I've got a backup. Here it is. And there's just one little, you know, like encoded string in there that's got, you know,
social engineering. Oh yeah. It's great.
You know, as you're talking about that too, there's this hacker or cross-site scripting cheat sheet. It's like mm-hmm. ha.ckers.org/xss.html. And anytime mm-hmm. you're feeling cocky about cross-site scripting, this thing is amazing for, like, there's just so many little tweaky hacks, you know, like mm-hmm. putting things in object tags that are double encoded, and, you know, putting stuff in, you know, just all kinds of things that you'd never think of, mm-hmm. you know, and weird escaping bugs in browsers and stuff.
Yep. And it's worth mentioning too that the anti-XSS library, I think, is really good, but I think they would be the first ones to tell you it's not perfect. And I kind of positioned cross-site scripting in the episode that we just did. I said, you know, you're not protected, and it's not a matter of did I protect the site. It's just a matter of when they're going to break you down. Because you will, if your site's popular enough and big enough, you will get attacked and you will be compromised. There's just no way around it. These guys are really smart.
Mm-hmm.
So I finally found the docs to the Twitter Anywhere thing, the at Anywhere.
Oh yeah,
looks interesting. I actually like the design of the API. It's very JavaScripty.
No,
like, yeah,
it's jQuery-ish, right?
You call it and then you pass it a callback, and the callback sets up like the options and things that you use on there on the page that you're linking it to, and it includes hover cards for which it should be shot.
Yeah, that is bad.
So what do you think about hover cards?
Hover cards?
Hovercraft.
Oh, just kill them.
Are there really hovercrafts? I mean, like in like common use wherever you live in Seattle?
They're outside your window.
Yes.
Is it like V? Is V happening right now? And I'm not noticing. Oh, yeah, there. I see it.
The freaky alien baby part, yes.
And I thought that was just a rooster in my backyard. What the heck?
So let's move on, shall we, to talk about JavaScript on the server.
Or should we talk about JavaScript in the view?
Okay.
Let's just talk about JavaScript. It seems to be the ubiquitous web thing.
It's getting all over the place. You know, Rob, this is kind of not somewhere you'd expect, but we were talking earlier today about Mongo or DB4.0. Which one was it? Was it Mongo?
Mongo.
Yes, we were talking earlier today about Mongo, and that, you know, that since it's a JSON object, your query is just like you're querying JSON. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, yeah. which is pretty neat. So you sent me that query that you sent, and it's like, I mean, just very simple.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, so Scott, John and I were talking about just stuff today, and we're talking about Mongo. And as you know, when you query Mongo, you send in functions, which query the BSON, the binary object notation that's in there. And it's kind of, it would be like a really interesting JavaScript trifecta, you know, if you had, oh dear, if you had it on the view, if you had it in the server, and you had it in your database. Whoa, that'd be scary.
Oh, that would be awesome. We'd finally have a productive language to use.
That's Scott Kuhn heaven right there, you just described.
You can't beat that, yeah.
So I need to look this up. I'm trying to remember if the Jaxter project has its own database or if it's just... I think Jaxter has a call that it has APIs on the server. Jaxter is a JavaScript server-side framework. It's hosted or created or something owned by Aptana, which makes that a JavaScript and RadRails IDE. They also provide like free cloud hosting for Jaxter apps. I think it's Jaxter. Huh. And Bertrand Leroy and I were kind of talking about it some last night as well. It's really well written, but I think it does just have API calls for like MySQL or, you know, DB2 or whatever weird databases you want to use. But yeah, so I was just thinking about the opportunities for being able to pass a function to your data layer for querying. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I told Rob that he might want to look into using for his views was a templating engine called mustache.js. Originally, it was actually a templating engine for Ruby, but for some reason they switched it to JavaScript only. And so the interesting thing about that is since you're passing a function to query, you know, off to the database server, that I'm assuming that function it's not required to return JSON back. It could return anything, right? Since it's just a function. Mm-hmm. So you could actually pass up a function with a reference to a mustache.js template and have your database server actually, you know, take the time to render this template and return the string to you for inclusion in your view. Now, I don't know what kind of, you know, boundaries that crosses, but
there's a guy who, oh man, and I apologize if you're listening to this. He, oh darn it, don't you hate getting old? I can't remember. He pinged me on Twitter, and he said that he had done queries straight to Mongo from JavaScript that did exactly that. Yeah, you would think that you have this convergence. It's actually kind of unsettling, and what you could do with the JavaScript.
I gotta say though, I'm flashing back to some site that I saw before, I don't remember where, years ago, where they were using T-SQL scripts to generate HTML that got spit back out on the
yep,
on the web server.
I think you're talking about your day job, Kevin.
The old Access stuff where you had the web forms you could generate from Access, and they tried to move it to SQL Server. But the difference there is that your code doesn't live in the database server when you do that. Your code actually lives in the view and just gets passed up.
Yeah, it's true.
Wow. Oh,
it's interesting too, thinking of like a recent change with jQuery allowed, like when you did a selection, it could call for each item, it could immediately call a function. Gosh, I forget what it was, but they had examples like showing zebra striping, and they were saying like, you know, select, you know, every other row, and each one was calling a function. And I don't know, it just seems like you could just go nuts with that kind of stuff, like a database query that the results, each one does something, or, you know, like you could go pretty wild.
Well, I wonder if you could actually within your function make calls back to Mongo, so you could have functions that go in and modify data and then return the results.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the whole MapReduce thing is all about, in a sense. It's pretty insane. You know, I was trying to wrap my mind around it when, you know, we're writing the link stuff for the Mongo driver, Norm. And I remember who was it? I was on with James Avery and also Andrew Taken. That's how you say his last name, by the way, Taken. Anyway, and, you know, we're doing like a little pair of sessions. And I remember just banging my head, you know, like, ah, this is crazy. How do I do this? And it's so funny that when it hits you, you know, it's like just a plain old JavaScript function. It's just going through like striping, like you're saying, you can build a function that does that. And it's weird to think in terms of code as a query tool. Whoa, it's really bizarre. Because you can think in terms of linked to SQL, but not something that evaluates row by row, you know?
And this kind of goes back to the whole, you know, you're not really abandoning the platform. You're bringing new things back to it. Mm-hmm. So when you start to write Ruby code, especially, but also JavaScript code. I've had a lot of people that have really learned how to write JavaScript code, and they learn about functions as first class objects and the idea of passing functions to parameters and, you know, rewriting functions as you go. And then it affects the way that they write C# code, or at least the way they want to write C# code. Mm-hmm. And they end up writing much smaller functions, and they end up passing things around, and they're not as scared of lambdas as they were before. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to see kind of, and I even found myself doing that, because like when anonymous delegates mm-hmm. first came out in 2.0, mm-hmm. you know, I was like, oh, finally I can do this, you know, the stuff that I've been doing all along in JavaScript. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, create this thing, pass it off, and let it do whatever.
You know, I had the same kind of feeling just in general at alt.net Seattle, going to all these different things that even if it was like, okay, this doesn't fit into my work right now, it would immediately like expand my mind as far as what I could do. And one obvious thing was like machine or MSpec or machine.specifications and showing, you know, the whole like the fluent syntax using just passing delegates around and using, you know, it's like you look at it for a second, you're like, wait a minute. Okay, that makes sense, you know, but it mm-hmm. takes a little bit to kind of wrap your mind around like why it's working. Not after you've seen it a few times, but it's that same kind of thing where you're just like, okay, I'm passing these things back and forth. And, you know, it definitely opens your mind up to the flexibility of the language, even in C#. So.
You know, one of the things that along the lines of what you're saying, Scott, is, you know, when you start messing around with Ruby, you know, you end up invariably working with code blocks and closures. And for a lot of developers like me, I didn't come up through traditional, you know, coding stuff through school. I kind of learned it all. I did take it in school, but I veered off into other things. Anyway, closures were kind of like, I remember the first time I saw the block, I was like, what? And then you kind of get into it, and then you understand how it works, and, you know, these code blocks work. But the implications of what it can do elude you until you really start getting into some deeper Ruby code, and you start to see these examples. And I'm using Ruby as one sample. There's so many others that use this kind of style of programming. But when, like, the power of code blocks is insane. And I mean, I'm not even going to try to explain it, but still, like, you could see the way these guys will cut their code in half by just implementing some sort of block with yield, you know? Can you hear the rooster?
I was just going to ask about that. Can JavaScript help with that at all?
I'd probably make more roosters. I'm sure it would make more roosters out there.
It'd be like the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah.
So talking about JavaScript also, Scott, this past weekend you showed off Node.js, or is it Node.js?
Indeed, I did. Node.js, yeah.
So that was cool. Yes.
Yeah, it was. I started thinking about, you know, because I just kind of went into it, since it's alt.net Seattle, it's open spaces. I didn't have like a big, you know, demo planned, or I was just like, hey, look at this cool thing I found. I have no idea what to do with it, kind of thing. All it is it's evented-based I/O. So it's a little server that you start up. You can you pass it it's all written in JavaScript. So it uses the Chrome V8 engine to execute the JavaScript. Wow. So it's smoking fast. But it's all server-side, and you just, you know, you start it up, node.js, and you pass it a script, and you can bring in things like an HTTP package. Start up an HTTP server and start responding to requests. But the thing about it is, since it's the main goal of it was that there will be no blocking calls in Node.js. And that's, you know, whether it's file-based, whether it's accessing a socket, there's no blocking calls, there's no threading issues. So when something happens, it fires off, it tells the kernel, it says, okay, so here's a job to do, notify me when you're done, and then it goes back to sleep. It doesn't start up a new thread and keep track of it and marshal things across it. It talks to the Linux kernel and says, here's the job. Tell me when it's done. You know, and just, you know, execute that callback to me. and then it wakes up and does the process, processes whatever the callback is. So on my little tiny netbook, which is just an Atom processor, not even one of the cooler Atom processors.
It's very tiny.
It's very tiny. I had the smallest screen out of anyone at Alt.net Seattle, including Brad Wilson with his iPad. It does have 2 gigs of RAM, but I was getting like 1500 requests per second, just returning, you know, a simple string from the server using Apache benchmark. So I demoed that, and I demoed a static file server. So it would just go and it would read whatever file name you passed in from the disk and write it back to the response stream. You know, very simple stuff. And you can find those scripts at node.js.org, or you know, just Google around for node.js, and you're going to find tons of sites out there. Simon Wilson wrote those two samples that I used. And they're very, very short. That's one of the things that I've noticed about JavaScript is I end up writing less code, even though some of it is noisier in terms of creating, you know, lambdas and stuff like that. I end up writing less code usually. So I was kind of thinking, you know, well, what can we do with this? Well, the people have already written stuff out there like MERB, Rails-style routes for it, so a way to register routes within Node.js. They've written some MVC frameworks for it. There was some other kind of socket communication. Someone wrote a chat server as a demo. One of the things I was thinking of, it might be interesting to see if you could write a pass-through proxy or a caching proxy in Node.js. Because I was thinking of it kind of from a practical standpoint. You know, yeah, this is great, but what do I use it for? What does this gain me over Apache or something else that someone knows? Well, you know, so you could set up, you know, 10 of these, 10 Node.js processes running on a pretty simple Linux box. If your site's getting hammered, say your marketing release finally hit the wire and you know, your site's getting hammered, you need to offload the cache maybe. So maybe a little caching proxy in Node.js might be kind of cool to do. You know, you just set up a simple little round robin. Maybe you don't even need a round robin. Since it's all callback based, maybe you just have one instance of Node serving up static content. You know, you're not gonna hit any kind of a threading issue as far as number of requests per second.
Yeah, I just saw a post on the YUI blog where they wrote basically a server-side DOM that runs in Node.js.
Oh, that's right.
Which to me that is a really cool approach, and I can't help but wonder if that is ultimately where web development should go. You know, this notion of having a totally disconnected, completely different implementation on the back end, you know, HTML generation on the front end just seems really inefficient, and you know, you end up with lots of duplication and validation logic, and you know, why don't we just have a DOM on the server and a DOM on the client, and you know, they're kind of the same thing. So, yeah, I'm intrigued by that whole model. And that's kind of the Jaxer model, too, right?
Yeah, I think so.
There's that rooster. Yeah. That's so much better than K-Scott's alarm clock. Well, it's just different.
It's still a bird.
I was going to say K-Scott's little tweets in the background.
All right, what do you guys think about the this Twitter business? I'll tell you one thing I thought was kind of cool was less, you know, glitzy or whatever, but just that they were going to archive all the tweets. All the tweets are going to the Library of Congress. Google's going to have some kind of search that's actually supposedly going to work.
I don't know. You know, Twitter is infuriating. That's just, they're infuriating. You know why? Oh, boy. They've got to be the stupidest group of people on the planet. I'm sorry. I just, you know, it's my opinion. How dumb can a group of people be? You have a really good idea, and that idea was so good, right? It is still so good. Somehow the idea is shining through their complete ignorance. For that, like, so I just forwarded you guys a little link a little while ago. The CEO basically says, revenue is a feature. And I just, you know, okay, what? I mean, you know, not only that, but the stupidity that company has shown with their security model. They're sitting on such a massive pile of information that it took a guy 4 hours to completely break in and steal all of their company records, strategies, financial projections, and everything. You know, their server password is password, right? The admin password to the Twitter account is happiness. You know, you see, you wonder, do they take their stuff seriously? And I know I sound really negative right now. I use Twitter. I like Twitter. The idea is one thing. The way that you run the business is another. And it's amazing to me to see these people somehow trusted to make any kind of business decision. Have they made any revenue for the entire time that they're up? Do I have a strong opinion about this? Yes. I find it actually offensive to the people out there who are working really, really hard And these guys can be so arrogant. But, you know, I guess maybe that's just the thing. You stumble onto a good idea and it kind of elevates you to a point where you can just throw business out of the window. And it's infuriating to me because, you know, I'm bootstrapping a business right now and it's really hard to like make rent, you know, and you see these guys at Twitter and they're like, oh, yeah, we'll get around to making money. What?
Well, part of that comes.
Where's your $160 million in funding there?
Exactly.
Right? But even then, okay. So I'm an investor, right? Sitting there, having written the check, and I see that these clowns have decided. Oh yeah, you know, password's a great password for our server. You know, I don't know why. I just, you know, I guess I'm coming off that security episode, so security's on the top of my mind. But when people do dumb things like that, you kind of think, how seriously are they taking their own business? You know what I mean?
Well, that always frustrated me, just the way that Twitter would always just die from time to time. And then they'd be, you know, people would make these excuses, but really it's, you know, you compare it to what goes on in financial markets or anywhere else. And it's like, obviously now there's more scale and they're able to keep the thing going. It's just, they didn't care, you know, they didn't care enough.
It's not even just, you know, the occasional fail whale. Like just today during their big, huge, massive conference, developer conference, not only did I see the mythical whale, but like two of Kevin's tweets to me didn't get through. They didn't show up in my main timeline. I got one out of three, and that's why I made a comment. I was like, you know, it's great that they have all this stuff, but maybe they should, you know, concentrate on actually delivering the content. It'd be great if these tweets would actually show up. And you know, it's still going on, but there's just so many people on the platform and using it. I mean, freaking, I'm sitting here looking at my stream. I've got Alyssa Milano. I've got Roger Ebert. I've got one of the publishers for DC Comics. I mean, you know, it's not just a bunch of us trying to get together for drinks at Mix or PDC anymore. Mm-hmm. It's a gigantic media platform.
You can forgive them for the exponential growth and having to deal with it. But I remember reading an article, and I forgot where I read it. I wish I could remember it. They, you know, one of their answers to their, you know, database overheating was that they had a guy sitting there who would manually restart it every. I think the period was every hour and a half, 2 hours, because the RAM would go through the roof. And I guess it was some sort of deal with MySQL. I don't know. But they had one database powering it with no failover. Mm-hmm. And you're just thinking, oh my God, you know, oh my God.
It's just, yeah, but yeah, it's just arrogance. And it's like, well, we can, I mean, it's, I don't think they sit there and go like, screw you. But I think there, it just comes off as a lot of arrogance.
I don't know. So like, you know, it's funny. You think about what would I do? You know, if I had Twitter, I'd probably freak out. I'd probably run for the hills. But I think the first thing I would do is call about 20 people smarter than me and scream, help. You know, and allow them to do whatever they're going to do.
Well, you know, that, and that's one thing you can really give, the Stack Overflow guys credit for, right? I mean, they have kept, the service has grown very quickly, and they've reached out to a lot of smart people, and not just about technology wise, but also about the, you know, UI and usability and all those things. You know, they've talked to people that have run successful sites like this, and it's, you hear them do it on their podcast. And I know they talk to a lot of other people, and it's like, that's just, you know, that is the opposite of arrogance, you know, and it's a good thing.
Yeah. And, you know, technical issues aside with Twitter.
I got to say one more technical issue that just drives me through the roof. It makes me just livid, which is hard to do. But so I follow a little over 700 people, and it never seems to go above that. Although I keep adding people in, I keep following more people, but mysteriously people drop off my following list. These are people I'm following, not people following me. And it drives me nuts. And so like, mm-hmm. after a while I'll be like, I'll see somebody retweet or I'll see somebody mention something. I'm like, wait a minute. I was following that. Why didn't I see that? And I'll go and I'm not following them anymore. And it just, and then I have to follow them and they get an email. I just started following them, which occasionally is, I feel embarrassed about, but it's just like, come on. Like that's as bad as a service going down as just, you know, like losing user data.
That's data loss.
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh.
I know. And it, you know, that there's just, you could pile on. So my ultimate point with my little rant was not so much, you know, you're just bashing on those guys because, you know, what would you do, you know, scaling a site like that? I'm not talking about that, really. Honestly, hey, it's a great problem to have. You know, I really don't know what I would do technically if I was in their shoes, but I can tell you, I would have more than one database. I'd fail it, you know, make sure I'd fail over. I'm reading this article right here in front of me. In April, just a year ago, they had like a slew of XSS attacks. Like, what? I mean, how much do you really have going in and coming out? You know, that you can't cover XSS-wise. You know what I mean? Really, it's update going in, update coming out. Yet, you know, in their API, bam, XSS attacks everywhere. I mean,
well, remember, they have multiple ways into. It's not just going in through that single text box. So they don't only have to cover that text box. They have to cover SMS messages. They have to cover API calls.
Yeah, it's the API specifically.
And so
but I'm saying, like, you know, you well, okay, fair enough. But you would imagine at some point they can say, okay, let's XSS, you know, check this. I don't know.
I agree. And I feel like, you know, that's something, again, where if you have a successful business, you've got multi-million dollars in funding, you know, you should bring in some experts, some penetration testing experts, some people that do this kind of stuff for a living, you know, and like, you should be finding these problems before anyone else does.
And your server password is password.
Right. Well, maybe it was.
Well, so along those lines, you know, you might think that the people at the Apache Server Foundation would be smarter than to do something like that.
Yeah, I guess
but
so.
They just got nailed.
Yes, they did.
And one of the reasons that they got nailed was because the I think it was the root password. One of the passwords that was compromised, that person used the same password on their the account on one of the Apache servers, and it just happened to have sudo access.
Oh boy. And don't tell me it was, yeah.
Have you read that, Rob? Have you read their report?
I went through it a little bit, and I saw that the passwords are stored in clear text, and it's that, you know, what people don't really grok about storing passwords in clear or in unencryptable text is that that's a magnet. So if you ever read Jeff Atwood's post, and I talk about this in the security thing on NBC2, in our episode, but you read his post about how his account was compromised again when someone logged in as him. It's because, you know, Jeff used the same password twice, but the one place that he used it only encrypted it. It didn't hash the password. And so this person was a developer, and he got curious because he saw Jeff's, you know, login. He went and MD5 reverse decrypted it, got his password, and thought, I'll see if I can log in as Jeff using OpenID on Stack Overflow. And guess what? And it's just one of those things. It's like, what have we seriously, you know, and it's funny. I love Jeff's article. You know, he basically says the enemy is us. And it's true. And it's funny because, you know, people only think about like the Reddit guys who lost their entire database. You remember this? They lost their entire database and had to come out and say, oh yeah, by the way, we didn't encrypt any passwords.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, what are you, stupid? Like, what, you know, and their opinion was, well, gosh, come on, this is just a comment site. What's anybody going to do with it? That's not the point. I mean, those passwords are private.
Right.
You know, they really should be treated as a social security number because people are dumb. I mean, when I say dumb, I mean like I'm dumb. We don't use unique passwords on different sites. And that's really hard. You see, what I'm doing right now is I'm giving people fodder on Twitter to call me Bellware because I'm calling people dumb.
Well, can I?
Well, you got to use longer words than that.
You got to throw in orthodoxy and.
That's true. Oh, shoot.
But the reason that we use the same passwords on different sites is because we had to remember so damn many passwords.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
I counted up once 2 years ago, and I had 35 passwords that I had to remember.
You know, the frustrating thing to me is that this is not this is a solved problem. Like, if I was using, for instance, if I was using OpenID across all the sites that I logged into, and OpenID supports, like my OpenID supports InfoCard, which you have to, like, you have to be sitting at my computer. You can't hack that over. I mean, it's basically impossible to hack that remotely, you know, and it's like this. And so I would never have to type a password into any website, like, you know, and no, even better, no website will store my password. Like, it's a solved problem, you know, but it's,
I agree,
like,
with that, yeah.
But we don't have that for some reason,
but we're coming along.
Yeah.
I gotta say.
Yeah. So Jeff wrote that on his, he wrote a post about that, OpenID, which I wish I could remember more of, having read that just earlier today.
It is a pain.
Well, that goes back to something good that Twitter might have done today. They released their Anywhere API that lets you put, you know, connect using Twitter, I think, what are we going to call it? Their OAuth kind of thing. So now you could, I don't know, you get, you basically you make a call to this and you get back a token that you can use to interact with that user's Twitter account. So if you wanted to put some kind of Twitter comments or annotations on your web page, or if you want your iPhone game, I guess, to be able to tweet someone's, you know, new badge, God help you, or when you become the mayor of somewhere, then you can do that using this API. Is that good? Is that bad? I don't know.
I just had a non-related flash, but you know, if it would be cool if there was Foursquare back when Napoleon was like, you know, on a rampage, because he would just be like, I just became mayor of, you know, wherever.
Emperor of.
Right.
I just became emperor of.
So, Napoleon just checked in at Waterloo.
Exactly.
So, oops. Yeah. But yeah, that looks cool. And so there's one thing, Kevin, you were mentioning earlier that you don't like about it, which is the hover cards.
Oh God, the hover cards.
So
yeah, the hover cards are a friggin' UI disaster, and now they're going to be all over the web.
So, but you've got a Grease Monkey script to help with that.
Yes. Well, I have a Grease Monkey script that works on Twitter.com.
Yes.
So it needs to be broadened.
Need to change that to star.
Exactly.
So did Twitter announce anything else?
Sponsored tweets, or what do they call them? Promoted tweets?
Something like that.
Yeah,
oh,
that's
goody.
What we need more of.
Yeah,
it's been so commercial free for so long. How can they even think about monetizing it?
But then you were just saying earlier about how you're upset at them for not having a business model. So what?
I think Obama should take over Twitter. I think the government needs to bail out Twitter.
Is it time for a government bail out of Twitter? I think in the latest healthcare bill. It was a pork option.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. Ready? Tinfoil hat time. I wouldn't be surprised if like Twitter said, you know what, we're going to go out of business. We can't raise any money. If the CIA or some like NSA or somebody came in and said, no, actually, we'll keep you around. Seriously.
So that was the other thing they announced today. The Library of Congress will be
archiving
tweets.
I like that. To me,
I don't know what that means.
Well, I think I think like going back to the irresponsibility stuff, but I can't believe that Twitter search doesn't work for more than like a few weeks ago. And I mostly use it as like, I actually care about the tweets as they're coming through. And a lot of like Elijah Manor, all the, you know, people that I'm following will tweet stuff and I'll go, that's cool. But I don't sit there and bookmark every single thing that comes through because I believe that I can get back to it later, you know? And so that's part of the reason I still keep a friend feed account is because I'm able to search old tweets on there. So anyhow, I'm happy about this that people are taking these seriously, you know?
One thing that I did a few years ago was I created a separate WordPress blog at my domain, and I set up the Twitter tools to import all my tweets. So now I have at least an archive of all of my tweets if I ever need to get to them for whatever reason.
Yeah, and there's some services out there that'll do that too. And normally at the cost of
free.
Well, yes. Those ones.
I'm using Google Reader for that, but yeah, same idea.
Yeah, and the nice thing is that with this blog, I attached Discus comments to it.
Yeah.
So every now and then I'll get notified that someone has left a comment on some tweet that I made. I don't know. Thought it was an interesting way to set up kind of a threaded conversation.
You've just recreated feed.
I'd always meant to go back and find some way of pulling in the replies that are in reply to that tweet, and I'm automatically storing them as comments so I can actually have, you know, full conversation on there since I knew like Twitter was unreliable. But the interesting thing that I thought came out of this conference was, and actually came out a few days before this conference, was the acquisition of Tweety and the fact that Twitter basically said, you know, stop writing clients that just add functionality to the site. And let us take care of that, and you go build things that use Twitter as kind of a social platform. So instead of you know, because all the stuff that's been added to the site has been user driven, it's, you know, the replies tab came about because everyone was doing that just organically, and the only thing that Twitter had was the timeline and direct messages, and then retweets came about, and you know, the fact that it would shrink URLs on the website came about from that. And so every client, you know, kind of fills in these new holes. So now they, you know, like Tweety has threaded conversations, or you can click on in reply to, at least on the iPhone app, and it'll show you, you know, a semi conversation between the two people that you're looking at. But Twitter basically said, you know, don't worry about all that. Just go and build things on top of this. But, you know, what else is there to do? That's the part I don't get. Maybe that's why I'm no James Avery. I can't turn projects and ideas into money because I don't have any good ideas or projects.
I work with James. I've known James a long time, and you're no James Avery. Uh-huh. Sorry. I had to go there.
We'll take that as a cue to move on to talking about, this should take no time at all because there's just going to be nothing but love for this one. Apple recently changing section 3.3.1 of their SDK agreement that says you have to use C, Objective-C, and JavaScript only to write iPhone.
Well, and it says originally.
Yes.
That's the even weirder part.
Right. Which shuts out two main things, which is the Adobe Flash-based cross-compiler thing, and then also MonoTouch. So, I'm sure we all love this decision. Should we just move on?
Oh, I know I'm going to be in the minority, but I applaud them. I think it's a good move. And I know Scott Kuhn's probably sharpening his knives. But here's why. And, you know, first off, I read these arguments online. And, you know, I saw DHH rant the other day about fascism and so on. And, you know, I understand the sentiment. And I understand how people can feel like, look, you're closing off a major platform. How's that going to help? Well, you know, you're crossing woulda, coulda, shoulda, and gosh, I wish I had a business, you know, I wish I could do what I normally do and make money off this with these people that are obsessively trying to control the quality of their platform. Now, I know that what I'm about to say is absolutely unrealistic. However, if somehow we lived in a world in which Microsoft could control the applications that were on your desktop and Microsoft was really good at controlling the quality of those applications, I think the world would be a very different place in terms of, you know, the applications you could run, the experience you have using their operating system. Because when, like, Scott, you sat down and tried to figure out Skype tonight, we had problems. What did you blame? You blame the operating system. That's the problem that Apple is trying to get over. And I think business-wise, yeah, man, I don't want to have 100 million rinky-dinky, ridiculous apps by people of varying skill levels that may or may not understand the capabilities of the platform. As a consumer, I just don't care. I really don't care. What I do care about is when I take my, you know, iPad outside and I point it up at the stars, my kid looks at it and says, there's an orange star. And I say, actually, it's a planet. And I expand the thing and I show her that it's Mars and that Mars is red. And then I move the iPad out of the way and I show her in the sky. And her eyes are just like, woohoo. And then, you know, I close the iPad and put it down. That experience to me is what they're going after. They couldn't give a crap what, you know, developers think. And I swear, when I read these rants about people talking about fascism and so on, well, yeah, it's their platform. It's their phone. This whole thing didn't exist until, you know, 3 years ago. I just, you know, I'm spellbound by it.
I think...
Okay.
No.
John, I'm going to let you go.
I'll just say one short thing, but
Then I'm going to have to go for a while.
Okay. I just want to point out one short thing that you said there, which I totally agree. I disagree with the sentiment, but you said it's their phone, and I think that's exactly how Apple sees it too. This is an Apple phone, and
it's their platform. Let's put it that way.
I don't see it that way. I really see. I get the idea when you use a Mac that it's your it's a privilege that you're allowed to use this Apple product. You know, and
well, I mean, is Windows yours?
Well, yeah. I mean, I get the feeling that Windows, I mean, is a lot more open, and the idea is like
when you wake up in the morning and it just restarted your computer after it fire hosed all the updates on, you still feel like it's yours.
Yeah, because I go in group policy and I turn that off.
All right, fair enough.
Okay, Scott Kuhn.
Don't hurt me.
No. So
should I go get a beer before you start this? I might.
No, this is nothing. But there's kind of two points here. First, I'm like the last guy who thinks that every platform to be accessible in every language. So on one end, I think as long as it supports JavaScript, all right, there we go. We've hit the ultimate language. We don't need to support any others. But, you know, I'm not against learning Objective-C to learn how to program a platform. I have to learn Java to program on Android. I have to learn C# and Silverlight to program a Phone 7. You know, so you got to learn Objective-C. They just put in a clause stating that, you know, well, you have to use one of these and we won't accept any others. You know, that part didn't bother me as much. But what does bother me is this idea that somehow by restricting developers to those languages, they will somehow increase the quality of the apps on the App Store. Now, if anyone has an iPhone who's listening right now, open it up and just click on categories and click on, like, you know, top 25 or top free. Okay, 18,000 cool jokes, 99 cents. Mm-hmm. Beer, 99 cents.
Yeah, but you're appealing
go ahead. No, wait. Before they outlawed them, how many See Boobs Now apps were there?
Right. But you're appealing to the common denominator. That's the thing they're trying to get away.
No, wait. But that's what they've got now.
And
no app gets into the store without being reviewed by Apple.
True.
So if you're worried about the quality of the apps, why don't they catch it at that level since they're already reviewing it? Because, you're looking at it, you can see whether or not it conforms to the UI guidelines, even though Apple breaks them with every release. Everyone breaks their UI guidelines with mm-hmm. every new release because you learn how to do things different. So you look at it and you say, is this good? Is this not good? And I mean, there's utter crap. I downloaded some app the other day that was, it said free sci-fi books.
You sure it wasn't the boobs one?
It wasn't the boobs one. It was free sci-fi books. I think it's still in there if you look under the books category. And you click on it, and the first thing it wants you to do is to buy the $1.99 version of the free app. So you don't. It's not even. It's a bait and switch. So they're not concerned about quality. They have an axe to grind against Adobe and Monotouch, yes. and everyone else is getting caught in the crossfire.
Yes.
And they just want to screw Adobe because they got upset because Adobe took their toys and made mm-hmm. them run on Windows low so many years ago.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that, but at the same time,
this idea that they're somehow going to increase quality by restricting the language that they can use is bunk because there's crappy apps written in Objective-C. I've seen them. I've run them.
Sure. I agree with you, but at the same time, you're also illustrating a problem that I think they're trying to get through. So, meaning like the boobs app, it's so easy for a run-of-the-mill Flash developer to say, hey, I know, I'll do one with rotating pictures of boobs and, cross-compile it, send it in, okay, it's an extreme example.
But all those were Objective-C apps.
Okay.
I think that...
How do you know that?
Because
the Flash cross compiler doesn't exist.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
So I think here Gruber wrote this article where he said, and I totally think he nailed it, where he just said, look, this is about, they want to control the platform in a way that it's not a commodity. So otherwise, let's say I can write an app in Monotouch and I can deploy it to the Droid, to the iPhone, and to a Windows phone because it's all .NET code. Well, that takes away some of the exclusivity of the iPhone. So what they're doing is this is kind of the whole monopoly thing, right? Where they're saying we have the majority phone share and we want to force people to make a decision. Do you write for the majority phone share or do you write for these little rinky dink guys or do you cross compile all over, write separate apps all over the place? So I think that's the whole idea is like you force people to say, I am committing to writing iPhone only applications.
Okay. Cause that bugged me, that whole thing with Gruber's article, because that conflates alternate programming languages with least common denominator cross-compilation, which are two totally different things. When you build something in Monotouch, you're building against all the native UI widgets, all the native, low-level APIs, UI Kit, CocoaTouch, all that stuff. You're not cross-compiling to some least common denominator platform-independent framework. So that was kind of a totally bogus argument to me.
Well, no, I think the idea is that if you, let's say you write a game, or whatever, yes, to make it run on Monotouch, yes, you're going to have to bind against against Cocoa and all that, but you're still able to reuse your application, at least parts of it, against multiple places.
Yeah, but Objective-C supports C, so you can do that anyways.
I don't know if we're arguing here. I think that what he was saying was that...
Yes, we are, damn it! To me, the crux is the control issue,
mm-hmm.
that they want to be able to control their platform and they don't want to be beholden to any other development tools.
Mm-hmm.
So if, for example, they want to make a change to, how the platform works and 10% of the most popular applications on there are built with Monotouch, well, now they have to wait till Monotouch catches up with their platform changes before they can roll them out, or they have to worry about breaking Monotouch,
mm-hmm.
And a Monotouch might be doing something freaky. It's just about control.
Well, yeah, I think we can all agree it's control.
It is about control. I think there's different, things about saying, well, why do they want that control? I really see it as it's like they have dominant market share and it's a way of kind of forcing.
I don't see it that way at all. Okay, let's take Kevin's house, for example. I know Kevin lives in a big house in the East Bay. Isn't it MC Hammer's old place up there in the Oakland Hills?
Absolutely. Got the big hammer on the gate.
Yeah. So like, you know, we decide to do a podcast at Kevin's house. We go up there, we bring the microphones, cameras, we do a video live thing. Turns out it's a big fat party. Everyone has a good time. And then next thing you know, next weekend, people just start showing up because it's a party at Kevin's house. And then, you know, Kevin's like getting online going, my house is pimp. Come on over and hang. Then all of a sudden, you know, people start bringing over little concession stands. They hang out in the front and they're like, I'm going to sell t-shirts for Kevin's house, you know, and then they're going to like bring their own drinks. They're going to bring their own bar. They're going to bring their own snacks. They're going to start setting things up. People get sick off of Kevin's, you know, snacks and they start yelling at Kevin. I got sick at your house because I ate these, you know, chicken wings that you know, K. Scott Allen brought over. And Kevin's like, wait. This is my house. This is my party. If anybody wants to bring anything, you got to check with me first. And that kind of thing makes perfect sense to me. The only problem is that I could see that the partygoers be like, Kevin, we've been coming to your house forever. How could you all of a sudden say the party's over? And then, you know, you're being a fascist jerk. And I could see all those things. But at the same time, I mean, you can't always be serving chicken wings at Kevin's. That's the summation there.
It's my house.
To me, it sounds a little like in that party scenario, it's more like you can only go to Kevin's party and you're not allowed to go to any other parties tonight. And for me, I usually like to hit at least two or three. And with that, I'm going to move on.
There it is. All right. Good enough.
Yeah. Can we move on then to the Visual Studio launch party?
Yes.
As long as you're not, you know, a one party kind of rule person. Anybody with thoughts on the Visual Studio?
Man, Visual Studios 2010 is tired. Where's my new beta?
No, you're right. I was scared, man, when I downloaded and installed it. It took about an hour and a half to install. Restarted my machine, I don't know, I think 13 times. I'm just kidding. Yeah, it was twice. But, you know, whatever. I was kind of scared. But, dude, it started up. It's freaking snappy. And I'm running a VM. And, you know, I was using 2008 today for the stuff I'm doing. And then I switched over because 2008 is too slow, you know, and running in a VM. And for some reason, the typography, the graphics and font rendering, I don't know what it is with 2008. It's slow if you're in a VM and you're running with full graphic arrow and, you know, enabled and everything. But, dude, 2010 was flying. I mean, it's really nice.
Yeah, I've been using it for a little while. I've been using RC. I'm just really happy in general. Like, it's, you know, even just little things like the being able to zoom in on the code, you know, and just I like the extensions. I've been playing with the extensions lately and found a bunch of extensions that made me happy. You know, and just all kinds of just little, you know, control comma to navigate the code. I'm happy. Kevin, Scott, you guys like it? Tried it.
I've installed it. I haven't gotten to do much with it yet.
It doesn't actually run VB. It doesn't run VB6, dude.
It doesn't run VB6, so I can't really do much.
Right.
No. I'm actually hopeful that we'll be able to start switching over to it because the stupid solution versioning stuff makes it very difficult to incrementally switch between Visual Studio versions.
There's an app for that.
Yeah.
The whole company has to kind of switch. Yeah, so you can switch back and forth.
So that app that somebody posted, that's a command line app. I'm waiting to see somebody do something even slicker, like when you open it, some kind of, there's a way around.
If only there was a team at Microsoft that actually worked on Visual Studio and could do things like that. Maybe if they even used Visual Studio while they were working on it.
I've heard that it's a big, like,
hey, so it's
a freaking text file.
it's WPF, right? I mean, isn't that the core of 2010?
Well, yes. I mean, the editor is.
No,
there's still a
Visual InterDev is the core of 2010.
Well,
still.
But so so if anybody's done any Visual Studio extensibility stuff, right? You have to get in and do Kevin Dente com kind of programming. And I was just sitting here playing with this today. I was thinking, how hard would it be to do a, you know, an add-in? And it's funny because, like, you know, Louis DeJardin and the Spark guys and the Haml guys have all been like, I really want to make this work in 2010, but we don't know what's going on in there. And I thought, gosh, I wonder if they completely moved off of the whole COM thing. Do you know?
I looked at it a little bit today. I mean, for the extensibility stuff, that's MEF. If I say it three times, I know Glenn will appear, so I'll just not say it again, hopefully. But so, I mean, that's pretty sweet, simple code. Like, I actually downloaded an extension and reflectored it and took a look at it. And, you know, that was pretty nice.
It was .NET code.
This was .NET code. Now, this was for an extension that was working with the WPF side. This was for working, you know, in the editor. So, but also I do know that for any of the add-in stuff, there's all that old stuff, the DTE and all that business.
Yuck.
So there's a combination. It's a mix of some .NET WPF stuff and then, you know, the shell. You know, there's still COM stuff. I think,
I'm opening it now, and it's the same exact dialogue. You know, select a programming language, create an add-in for blah blah blah.
Right.
Yeah. All right.
Connect.cs.
So one thing we keep harping on various lists and in public and at conferences and whatnot is we want a slim down, trim .NET editor. I don't even care if it's Visual Studio anymore. Mm-hmm. I want a text mate. I want a Vim with some IntelliSense, maybe that understands MS build files. You know, I don't care about design services. I don't care about connecting to SQL servers.
Well, you know,
you
can
not SCM integration necessarily.
We should. I was just thinking about this in the morning about writing like an online editor.
Well, there's Bespin.
You know? Yeah, but you know that.
Well, there's one already.
There's another one too.
What's it called? Run code or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing I was going to say, there's the in Visual Studio 2010, there's the code optimized web development profile. And I'm absolutely reading this. Otherwise, I would not have said that right. But yeah. it shuts all that stuff off. So, it's pretty.
No.
It's pretty trimmed down. I mean, it doesn't have a bunch of.
No, because they've still got all this stuff loaded up in the IDE itself. So even though you're not using it, it's still there lurking behind I unknown.
Oh, there is code run. Oh,
behind there. I unknown. I'm still kind
of... You had to think about it, huh?
Well, it's not until you call
I unknown. Would I dispatch have been funnier?
If I dispatch is not called, does it make a sound?
So, and that's really, I mean, that's kind of the crux of it. They've got all this kind of baggage that they've had to pull along for backwards compatibility. And they have all this stuff in there that they think makes developers more productive and that they think we really, really want. But, you know, there's a segment of us that doesn't really care about all that junk. And if, yeah. You know, and if a team was to get a wild hair up their keister and to, you know, do a little Skunkworks, do a little IDE, do a little, you know, Emacs.net, but don't turn it into some Oslo editor that no one cares about.
Right, that's what IntelliPad was originally implied that it was going to be, but totally wasn't in any way.
Wow. Well, you know, it's interesting from doing the, you know, Ruby stuff that I've been doing, you get used to TextMate really quack, really fast. I need another beer. You get used to TextMate so fast and the little macros that are in there and the bundles you can download that, you know, people say, I don't have my IntelliSense. But by the time you get used to these macros, you are flying so fast. Yeah, and I know we have snippets in Visual Studio, and I'm not trying to compare Visual Studio to TextMate. I'm just saying the lightweight nature of TextMate is just wonderful. And yeah, I was just thinking this other day, geez, can't we have something like this?
Yeah, it's one thing I've noticed from RubyMine is using RubyMine is I can definitely see the appeal of going that direction. RubyMine is so fat, even in comparison to Visual Studio.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and you guys missed the best demo ever. I got to find this. It was at Alt.NET Seattle. This guy, Python and Ruby dev named Gary Bernhardt, gave us a demo of how he kind of does software development on Unix. His idea was, you know, if people are interested, you know, in your Windows devs and you've never used Unix or Linux, I can show you, you know, kind of how I do things. And he showed an example of using, you know, awk instead of grep at the command line to pull out all the most used functions in the Django framework. But and let me find this. You've got to see how he uses Vim. It's incredible.
Oh, you get a Vim ninja going. You get those Vim guys are freaks of nature. Well, too, you know, Kevin, while Kate or Scott Coons are typing, plunking away, you know, if you ever watch, maybe you have the Railscasts, you know, and you even watch like Ryan Bates like scream through TextMate, and you think, can I code that quick in Visual Studio? I don't know. I mean, I can't, but I know some people can. Some people are really fast with all the shortcuts, but geez Louise, macros versus shortcuts and snippets are completely separate beasts.
Yeah, I'm treating RubyMine as kind of my gateway drug, like mm-hmm. sure. because I still need a little IntelliSense because I don't know any of the APIs mm-hmm. yet. But sure. I can really see when once you get that stuff down a little bit more that the more lightweight approach is definitely appealing.
Okay, here I found it. He does the string calculator. Little kata in Python. And he says he actually slows down intentionally, typing slower, inserting pauses so that they can kind of, so the viewer can see what he's doing.
I remember seeing that. Yeah.
And just the way that he had like his vimrc, their config file for vim, is several hundred lines long. just the way he's got it set up. It's amazing, and you look at something like that and you think, God, if I could learn how to do it that good, I'd never ever use Visual Studio again. Not only do you not miss IntelliSense, but you don't miss all the find and wares and even some of the refactoring stuff. But a lot of people are hoping that MonoDevelop will be that slimmed down interface for editing.NET stuff, and supposedly the JetBrains folks are working on a ReSharper plugin for MonoDevelop.
I used MonoDevelop the other day, and I hate to sound negative with, you know, projects like that, but I used it on a Mac. I don't know if that makes a difference. It just was not a very good experience. Stuff was freezing. Code windows weren't expanding. Things just weren't working out very well. But, you know, hey, I mean, I know it's a free thing, and I know those guys are so smart. They'll figure it out. But it's also felt to me like it was going kind of the big IDE thing. You know, like, let's pack as many tools you might need in here, you know, versus letting you write really, you know, text really fast, which is a complete fundamental shift between like TextMate and Vim, Vi and whatever, Emacs, that, you know, they embrace it as a text editor. You're just writing text. Yeah. And it seems like Visual Studio is like, you're writing .NET code, well, and we're going to help you do that.
I usually end up doing, you know, like I have Notepad++ and I have Visual Studio. So when I'm writing C# code, then that's what I use Visual Studio for. And then, you know, anytime I even am getting into like, okay, I'm editing Visual Studio code, but I'm thinking of it as text, and I pop into Notepad++, and there's tons of stuff in there. It's not TextMate, but it does have a ton of like add-ins and plugins and macros and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yep.
We're almost at 2 hours, so we should definitely wrap up.
Yep.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could probably trim out a bunch of stuff that we talked about. I mean, I don't know.
I probably could. Okay. Well,
take Rob's part out.
Right. I'll run the anti-Rob filter. Rob, do you have any last thoughts, or do you want to pimp something? Because then I can play the music.
You might really want to play the music. I can figure out something to pimp.
Hmm.
All right. I'll pimp something. You ready?
Yes.
Okay. Here we go. Cue the music, John. Kick it. So two things that are kind of fun. Of course, I have to pimp Tech Club because that's what I do. But I'm going to wrap up the MVC series this week, and I'm going to be creating a starter site and hopefully bring in some special guests and talk through kind of what have we all discovered and learned together along this journey. Let's put together a starter site based on all those things. And then after I do that, that'll be our 15th episode, and that'll cap off the whole thing. And then I'm going to launch into my next effort, which is going to be Sinatra and Haml and SAS and Mongo, kind of just bleeding edge web development stuff, just to show people what's out there. And that'll be my next effort.
Awesome.
Tech Pub. Yep.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have this week and then some. So good night, and thank you very much, Rob.
I love you all.
All right.